Really, one of the world's most preeminent commentators when it comes to Islam and the Middle East is Daniel Pipes. He is the founder and president of the Middle East Forum. And I did want to get him on the phone to discuss what is going on in the Middle East at the moment. We've got the situation in Syria. We've still got, of course, Egypt bubbling along at a disturbing rate. There is tensions remaining in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Tunisia, you name it, from the north of Africa through to the Middle East proper, there is trouble. Not that that's anything particularly new, but it seems rather acute at the moment, and I've got the hunch that Western foreign policy isn't helping. But Daniel also wrote recently about the fracturing of this collective Islamist push. And just as in Monty Python, now we had the Judean People's Front, the People's Front of Judea, so it seems that in a more serious sense, the great threat that is posed by a curtain, an iron curtain, if you will, of unified Islamism, may be breaking down thanks to internal tensions which are coming to the fore among the Muslim groups, the Islamist groups, now that they have sniffed an element of power which they managed to keep papered over when in opposition fighting a common enemy. Well, for some details on all of this, Daniel Pipes, I'm glad to say, is on the line, and I think we find him in Athens. G'day, Daniel.
Yes. Good morning.
Thanks for joining me. The situation in the Middle East now, of course, is precarious. It often is. But what's the latest as far as you read it in Syria, for example?
In Syria, it appears to me that there is a stalemate that has emerged. The Kurds in the northeast are looking to their ethnic brethren in Iraq, and the government and the rebels are fighting it out in the rest of the country, and there's not much movement. And I expect that there won't be much movement, but there is an effective division of the country between the two sides. Now, it's murderous, it's brutal. There is a humanitarian crisis looming as the winter comes to the northern hemisphere. But in terms of positioning and strength, I think they're rather similar.
Yeah, tell me, Daniel, the so-called Arab Spring, I mean, it had such warm and fuzzy connotations about that kind of vernacular, but in reality it's turned out to be a bit more of a Middle Eastern winter, hasn't it, in that instead of this great hope of democracy flourishing and the youth getting their say and all of this, it really, as far as I can see anyway, you know more about it than I, but as far as I can see, it's just turned into a free-for-all for Islamic fundamentalists and hardliners.
Exactly. In the first few months, which, by the way, was in the winter of 2011, not spring, it was the youth, the more secular elements, who were at the lead, but they were quickly brushed aside by the better organized Islamist groups, who, as you point out, have dominated since then. So it's a fight between the rear guard, brutal tyrants, and the new Islamist-oriented rebel groups, and this is taking place in many parts of the region, and as you suggest in your commentary, it's even more acute today than it is at most any time in the last century.
What about Western governments' involvement with this? Now, of course, the Obama administration seemed to be, on face value anyway, quite encouraging of the Muslim Brotherhood, well, of the change of guard in Egypt the other year. Of course, in Syria, there's even been agitation and the signs, anyway, by and large, coming out of Washington are that they'd prefer that the so-called rebels, and we'll look at them in some detail in a sec, gain the ascendancy over the Assad regime. Our foreign minister, be it Rudd or Carr or whoever it is, has been equally vocal, like many European societies, in having this take place. Do we really, though, know what we're getting ourselves into if we topple some of these hard guys?
Excuse me. You're right to point out a certain consistency in both the Rudd government and the Obama administration, which tends to be to reach out to one's adversaries and to brush aside one's friends. And this is not going over very well. You've had a change in government. We have not. We're not going to have one for another 3+ years. And the problems are growing and growing. And the Saudis have shown real unhappiness. The Egyptians are very unhappy. The Israelis are quite unhappy. Our allies in the region are not pleased, whereas our opponents are really quite pleased, starting with Iran and also Hamas and also the Palestinian Authority, the agents of our adversaries. So it is a dismal time for Western foreign policy as a whole.
Maybe the Muslim Brotherhood and others would be looking at us and saying, well, with enemies like that, who needs friends?
Exactly. Now, as you suggested at the beginning of the program, I see that the Islamists, who were as recently as the beginning of this year quite solid and quite popular, are having two major problems. One is that they're fighting among themselves. I can give you lots of incidents in many countries. And the other is that as Muslims get to know the Islamists, they don't like them. And the most dramatic example of that, of course, was in Egypt, where tens of millions of people went out in the streets at the end of June.
I suppose that shows, doesn't it, that to look at our foreign policies again, that whoever's advising the powers that be or the powers that be themselves have a very shallow understanding of Middle Eastern politics, because to back people that rational people like you would have pointed out really weren't that popular beyond their supporter base seemed terribly short-sighted and has led to a power vacuum and destabilization force greater than what existed when the hard men were there with their adversarial tensions that were in place.
Even worse than what you're saying is that it would be comparable to supporting fascists and communists.
True.
Our most deadly enemies. And even if they are in somewhat softer form, even if they use tactics which are, say, electoral rather than violent, they are still our enemies. They despise our civilization. They want to replace it with their own. They want to impose Islamic law, which is a medieval code that is completely incompatible with the way we live. And yet our governments, particularly my government, the U.S. government, is working with them and in fact helping them.
It's a very strange time in which we live. Now, the issue of refugees coming out of a conflict like Syria, and of course you can name any conflict there is going to be human spillage out of that, is one that you've spent much time thinking about and writing about. And you made a very good point in the piece that you wrote for the Washington Times on the 24th of September this year, where you titled it, Let Refugees Remain in Their Own Culture Zones. Now, a lot of people call me and say, why is a Christian, a predominantly Judeo-Christian society like Australia, taking in all these predominantly Islamic refugees, whom will struggle to integrate, and in many cases who do not want to integrate at all, whereas countries like Saudi Arabia basically have a closed-door policy?
It's very interesting that Syria is very close to Saudi Arabia. It shares climate, it shares religion, it shares language. Saudi Arabia is extremely large. It has vast open spaces. And yet no one thinks of the refugees going to a culture that is similar and a territory that's close to Syria. They think of places like Australia and North America.
And it's not like the Saudis are short of a quid.
Very different.
It's not like the Saudis are short of a quid. I mean, they're a pretty wealthy society, as is Qatar, as is Kuwait.
Exactly. So what I argued in that article that you mentioned is that we should stop assuming that the West will always be the place to which refugees flee. Why don't they go closer to a cultural zone that is much more familiar to them, where they can much more readily return home, where they don't have the conflicts that they have when they move to the West? Mm. And there's so many, from alcohol and pork to skimpy bathing suits and mixed social life, to all sorts of laws that are incompatible with their way of life. If they want to have polygamy, go to Saudi Arabia. It's quite acceptable there.
As is a whole lot of other things we find quite distasteful.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Why is it then that the Western governments and many in our society, short of the fifth columnists among us, want to encourage such great numbers of these people to resettle here as so-called refugees? I mean, if, as what you point out is true, and I have no doubt that it is, I concur with you on this, why is it that there are so many people out here that say, oh, bring them in, they'll fit in great, multiculturalism's done well,
I would say two motives stand behind that. One is a sense of pity and sympathy for the refugees, who are in many cases in a very desperate state, to be sure. And the second is a sense that there's nothing so great about Western culture. It would be better to have multiculturalism, that is to say, a medley of cultures. And they prefer to have other cultures, particularly the Islamic culture, which has got historic difficulties and differences with Western culture. They'd rather have it here in the West. And so there is a subversive quality that, you know, what's so great about Western culture anyway? You know, let's bring it down a notch or two.
Mm. You're saying that is from some of our so-called the trendies on the left out here that devalue the supremacy of our societies and want to...
That is definitely a leftist impulse.
The all cultures are equal idea. Well, you know, you've got prime ministers and leaders...
Well, even worse. But, I mean, the Western culture is worse than other cultures.
Yeah, well...
But there's something guilty about imperialism, racism, fascism, that Western culture should die, that other cultures should take over. And it's more extreme of expressions when one hears that. But, you know, Western culture is bad.
Yes. I'm speaking with Daniel Pipes, the founder and president of the Middle East Forum. Daniel, you've got leaders, of course, that are finally waking up to the nonsense that is multiculturalism. You've got the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the British Prime Minister David Cameron, in a rather rare showing of conservatism, came out against multiculturalism. You've had the Dutch, of course, question it by and large, and others in Europe. Even out here, many politicians and people are really saying, look, you know, has it really been, okay, we've got a bit of diversity on the high street when it comes to dining options, but aside from that, it brings its problems. As you point out, many of the people that do come from the Middle East as refugees, not all, but many, have a very great disdain, really, for our society, and they have absolutely no intention whatsoever of, you know, mucking in, to use that expression. In fact, they'd be much more happy if Australia or America became a little bit like, say, Syria or Egypt, just in a different part of the world with the welfare state added.
And this explains the collusion between the left, especially the hard left, and the Islamists. They share a disdain, a disapproval, a wish to undermine Western civilization. Now, they want to take it in different directions. One wants to take it in the leftist direction, the other in the Islamist direction. But in the short term, they agree in, you know, say, despising George W. Bush as a symbol, or the church, or other manifestations, and they work together. And so it's, from the leftist point of view, useful to have a larger element in the population that doesn't like the prevailing culture.
What about the Christians in these societies, and I suppose to a lesser extent the few Jews that are left in places like Iraq or Syria or Egypt? Of course, the Coptic Egyptians, 10% of the population, suffering about 90% of the rejection and the discrimination. I suppose it would be perhaps the point you could argue that, you know, societies like America and Australia, predominantly Judeo-Christian societies, would perhaps benefit from taking some of them in as refugees there.
Yes, indeed. There was a virtual cleansing of the Middle East of Jews in the 1940s and 50s. 1 million was reduced to maybe 30,000. And now we're seeing a similar process vis-a-vis the Christians, where maybe 15 million will be reduced to a fraction of that, whether it be Turkey or Iraq or Syria or Lebanon or Egypt. There is a hostile environment, and the Christians are leaving in substantial numbers. And I do think that, unlike what I said about Muslims going to Saudi Arabia, the Christians should be welcome in the West. It is their cultural homeland in a way that Saudi Arabia is not.
Yeah, I suppose there are a few cultural things that need to be overcome to assimilate, but at least the religious side of things, in which Islam is so divergent as a lifestyle to the Western life, it is not a stumbling block for these people. So an assimilation of sorts would be much more simple.
Christians from the Middle East share some cultural elements with their Muslim neighbors, but historically Christians and Jews from the Middle East have found it quite easy to adapt to Western ways and have been successful.
You say of this fracturing of the Islamic population, now that a lot of these movements have gained the ascendancy, you say, should the fissiparius tendency hold, that the Islamist movement is doomed, like fascism and communism, to be no more really than a civilizational threat inflicting immense danger but never prevailing. Is that something you still believe may well come true?
I'm presenting that as a possibility. I'm not predicting it. It's too soon. The evidence is too limited to draw definite conclusions. But I think there is a glimmering of possibility of this of Islamism having peaked and now being on the descent that I didn't see as recently as a half year ago.
What about these converts? I mean, they, like with any sort of thing, those who are from one culture then convert into something else, be they sports fans or, in this case, you know, Christians going to Islam, would tend to be almost the most fanatical and the most diehard adherents. We've seen, of course, with that dreadful situation in the Nairobi Mall, the Westgate Mall, I think it was, recently, a large number of the so-called Boko Haram terrorists being originally from Western societies, America, Britain, and the like. How great a threat are these homegrown terrorists to Western societies?
Well, Boko Haram is in Nigeria, not in Kenya. And they, the Western terrorists were of Muslim origin, were not converts. There is definitely a movement between religions. And I might note that just as the converts to Islam tend to be, can often be quite extreme, so the converts out of Islam tend to be quite extreme there, seeing Islam as an evil force and being very, very anti-Islamic. It's not as much noted and nonviolent, but it is. They are significant in terms of understanding Islam. One sees more and more ex-Muslims are writing books explaining their former religion to non-Muslims, where it's extremely harsh. To go back to your question, yes, converts are a significant and growing phenomenon, and some of them become terrorists. Others become law-abiding citizens, but want to move the culture in the direction of Islam. And because they come from within the culture, because they look like the majority people, they generally have more impact than immigrants.
Yes. Just finally, before I let you go, because I know you're busy in Athens there, one last question. How great a threat is Islamism to the West and, well, to the world in general, but certainly to the Middle East as one area, of course, with the political tension we're seeing at the moment, and then to the world as a whole? I mean, Australia, of course, has the most populous Islamic country to its north in Indonesia. How great a threat is this rise of Islamism to our way of life?
Well, I see it as the third of the modern totalitarian movements after fascism and communism. Now, clearly, it is limited to the Muslim population, which is not small, over a billion people. But it is alive in a way that fascism and communism no longer are vibrant and threatening. And it is, Islamism is the great challenge of our era. Or put it differently, the rise of China as a great power and the rise of Islamism as an extreme ideology are the two great threats of our time.
Will those two ever come into conflict?
They already have. But there are Muslims in China who are doing battle with the state. But I don't think that is the major issue. No, I don't. I think they're more parallel than in conflict.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Daniel Pipes. I thank you for your time.
Thank you for the invitation to join your show.